More generally, there is no reported long, endlessly repeated discussions about the dishonesty of our propaganda. The troops' overwhelming feeling was that while Germany might delay or even avert defeat, it could no longer achieve victory. The best the long-term future seemed to offer was an increasingly debilitating stalemate. "There's no way we'll be finished with the Bolshevik colossus this year," wrote Wachtmeister Josef L. of the 129th Infantry Division. Unteroffizier Wolfgang S. found it really depressing being absolutely powerless to do anything about a situation that seems to have no end. This is how a convict must feel. Numerous field commanders began calling for the troops to receive more intensive ideological instruction. General Heinritzi, now commanding the 4th Army in the Army Group Center sector, identified 5 subjects that he believed the troops' education should cover. 1. The meaning of the war. 2. Our enemy's aims. 3. Winning total war. 4. There can be no compromise. And 5. Why do we fight? One of the more hardline ideological commanders, set for ever greater prominence during the war's final 2 years, was General of Infantry Lothar Rendulic, who commanded 35 Corps. He judged the troops' ideological instruction as poor and inadequate, and maintained that being tested in physically and psychologically demanding situations was the only way for the soldier to become the exponent of this nation's will. From April 1943, Rendulic instructed his divisions to organize 3 14-day courses, giving all participants a solid base of political knowledge. Calls such as these from senior commanders at the sharp end proliferated during 1943. They would eventually help precipitate the greatly intensified indoctrination drive that high command would announce at the end of the year. Yet there was no escaping the fact that, in Catherine Merridale's words, the Germans were facing a kind of anti-progress, losing one by one the things that made them feel human. Red Army men, by contrast, were getting their first scent of real success. Buoyant from its success at Stalingrad, the Red Army immediately sought to repeat it with another massive encirclement of German forces in the southern Soviet Union. By stopping Operation Winter Storm, the Red Army had already driven a wedge between Manstein's Army Group Don and the remnant of Weich's Army Group B to its north. The Red Army's next targets were Army Group Don itself and Army Group A in the Caucasus. The Germans were able to avert further calamity, if only temporarily. General Zeitzler had already managed to persuade Hitler to allow Field Marshal von Kleist's Army Group A to pull out of the Caucasus. For the troops in the Caucasus, the retreat could not come quickly enough. "An 8-day-long snowstorm," wrote Unteroffizier Dieter S. of the 4th Mountain Division on 20 January. "When it abated, the damned Russians attacked. They were 150 meters, 500 feet, from us, and we had our hands full throwing them out with carbines, hand grenades, and machine pistols. I copped one in the head." Kleist had been planning a retreat from the Caucasus for some time. The Red Army's Trans-Caucasus Front pursued the Germans somewhat feebly, and the Luftwaffe was able to keep open an escape route through Rostov. Army Group A was thus able to escape the Caucasus just before the Soviet jaws closed. Hitler had not abandoned his intention of conquering the region, so he insisted the 17th Army retain control of the Kuban bridgehead. But in deciding on general withdrawal otherwise, Hitler showed he was not entirely blind to the lessons of the Stalingrad campaign, and not always guilty of the blinkered refusal to withdraw of which Manstein and others later accused him. Then the Soviet offensive against Army Group Don began running low on fuel and supplies, and Manstein was able to stabilize his line on the River Meuse. Manstein now sought to salvage something further. He maintained that the disasters in the south demonstrated that the Eastern Front needed a separate commander-in-chief, someone able to give that theater his full attention. Hitler responded badly to this argument, but rather better to the argument that the Germans should not simply stand and hold in the south. He gave Manstein free operational maneuver and allowed him to abandon the eastern Donbass. He also appointed Manstein commander of Army Group South. During the first half of March, Manstein drew the Red Army in to a point north of his forces where its supply lines became even more dangerously overstretched, all the while withdrawing his own troops and waiting for the moment to counterattack. The bulk of the troops he committed to this counteroffensive were grouped under a reinforced 4th Panzer Army, now augmented by 57 Corps, 48 Panzer Corps, and the new SS Panzer Corps, which had been formed in the autumn of 1942. Manstein calculated that recapturing Kharkov would animate the SS troops, who had been driven out of it the previous month, and believed it would act as a magic stimulus for the fighting troops and less senior command staffs. The Luftwaffe helped to delay and soften up the Soviet armor. Then, having picked his moment, Manstein turned his troops against the Soviets and hit them in their overextended southern flank below Kharkov. The Soviets had to withdraw to escape annihilation. This third battle of Kharkov, following the Germans' capture of the city in 1941 and the Soviets' failure to retake it in 1942, showed that even after Stalingrad, the German army's operational art was still superior to the Red Army's. The Soviets' defeat showed they had some way to go in planning an effective offensive against sturdy German opposition rather than against mediocre Allied and satellite forces. The Red Army's general over-optimism and its poor intelligence, both of which had convinced it that Manstein's forces were in headlong retreat, had proven particularly damaging. Helped further by the spring thaw, the Third Battle of Kharkov enabled the Germans to stabilize the hitherto perilous situation in the south and straighten out the front line. However, because Manstein lacked reserves and his victorious troops were now exhausted, this was all the battle achieved. There was no means of exploiting the victory further. Indeed, Manstein himself saw this, writing, "One should not let oneself be influenced by momentary situations." Kharkov had indeed merely achieved something momentary, a brief German recovery from the wreckage of the winter campaign. If the German army was to stabilize the Eastern Front for a longer period, it needed a more spectacular victory. Something special was also needed to strengthen the resolve of Germany's increasingly jittery Axis allies. The greatest worry here was Italy. The Italians had not only suffered fearful losses during the Stalingrad campaign, they also faced the prospect of Allied invasion from North Africa. In late 1942, while Rommel's forces retreated out of Egypt and Anglo-American forces converged on them from east and west, newly arrived German and Italian formations were trying to shore up the Axis presence in North Africa. The Axis had abandoned any ambition to hold on to Libya, let alone renew the offensive into Egypt. Its priority now was to maintain a bridgehead in Tunisia, and to keep the two Allied advances separate and thereby force them to use double the number of supply lines. Hitler believed this bridgehead was essential to keeping the Allies away from Italy, and in keeping Italy in the war. While Field Marshal Montgomery continued his somewhat stately pursuit of Rommel in the east, the joint Allied force advancing from the west was slowed by the mountainous terrain of northwest Africa. Newly arrived Axis forces were thus able to establish a bridgehead well before the Allies reached Tunisia. The first German commander on the spot was Lieutenant General Walter Nehring. Nehring was placed in charge of the newly formed 90 Corps, later renamed the 5th Panzer Army, on 17 November, even though its initial strength comprised fewer than 25,000 German and Italian troops. Nehring countered the Allies' initial attacks on the Tunisian bridgehead. The time bought enabled stronger German forces under Colonel General Hans-Jürgen von Arnim to reinforce the bridgehead. By the start of February 1943, over 100,000 Axis troops had arrived, including three new German army divisions and the remains of Rommel's German-Italian Panzer Army. Facing them along Tunisia's western dorsal were the British 1st Army, U.S. 2 Corps, and the French 19 Corps, which consisted of Free French colonial troops from North Africa. The Axis had temporary numerical superiority. This would disappear, however, as soon as Montgomery's 8th Army arrived from the east. The Axis forces were at the very end of a very, very precarious supply line across a Mediterranean Sea that the Allies now dominated unassailably. They had to go to desperate lengths to conserve what got through to them or what they already had. At one point, the 15th Panzer Division had to step in to forbid its men from trading pieces of uniform for goods from local Arabs, reminding them, "The uniform is the soldier's robe of honor, and not some civilian rags to be chucked away." Indeed, because Tunisia's greater population density threw up new day-to-day challenges, the 15th Panzer Division produced a poem for its men fighting Allied panzers, tanks, the better to ensure they avoided firing on the locals accidentally. Firing in Tunisia can bring trouble on your head. You might not hit a panzer, but an Arab's hut instead. Wear spectacles to help you and make sure you've got the nous to fire on a panzer and not an Arab's house. Rommel's arrival in Tunisia caused friction between himself and Arnim, a stiff old-school Prussian who was contemptuous of the Nazi regime. Rommel, though his disillusionment with Hitler had already begun, was Arnim's opponent in nearly every respect. Field Marshal Kesselring had his work cut out trying to get them to cooperate. Yet the Axis forces in Tunisia did hold advantages. Among them was a small number of the new heavy Mark VI Panzer, the Tiger, whose 88mm gun was much superior to the Sherman's 75mm. The Tigers were a headline product of Germany's now greatly improving armaments output. From late 1942, the top priority was armored fighting vehicles. In September, Speer announced a monthly production target of 50 Tigers, 600 of the new Mark V Panzer medium tanks, 150 light tanks, and a mix of 600 mobile assault guns and self-propelled artillery pieces. Tank factories were ordered to go over to a 72-hour working week. Favoring the defenders even more was the Tunisian terrain. This was no longer war in the desert, but war across mountains and ravines. The Germans were particularly adept at placing their artillery and machine guns in commanding positions on ridges. Tunisian terrain guaranteed heavy losses for any army attacking it. Even more so if that army was at the foot of a steep learning curve. The U.S. Army in Tunisia, under the overall charge of General Dwight D. Eisenhower, learned from its mistakes faster than the British learned from theirs in the Western Desert, but the process was still painful. The starkest contrast between German and U.S. forces in Tunisia was that the German forces contained a large core of hardened combat veterans, particularly among the Afrika Corps, whereas the U.S. Army was overwhelmingly an army of newly recruited, uniformed citizens. The United States' isolationist stance following the First World War and the financial priorities of the interwar years, not least during the Great Depression, had debilitated the country's armed forces. The danger of war and the German triumphs of 1939 to 1941 had jolted the U.S. Army into developing an armored warfare capacity. However, the U.S. Army relied much less than the Germans on skillful maneuver and operational art, and much more on General Ulysses S. Grant's 80-year-old doctrine of grinding down the enemy with superior resources. In order to do this as effectively and efficiently as possible, the U.S. Army organized itself along scientific management lines. This approach had advantages. For one thing, it did not suffer the adverse effects of having two high command offices. However, the scientific approach also created a top-down command style that required officers to weigh up all relevant factors in any given battle situation before deciding which course of action to take. This left them little room for surprise, improvisation, or initiative. U.S. Army basic training was shorter than its German equivalent, and placed less importance on developing the men's psychological and physical attributes. Instead, it sought to develop their skills in particular tasks, breaking down those tasks into smaller components. Nor, on the whole, were U.S. soldiers placed in regionally based units as German soldiers were. This extensively deprived the U.S. Army of the benefits to morale of raising, training, and deploying soldiers from the same region together in the same unit. U.S. NCOs were particularly inferior to their German counterparts, for the interwar U.S. Army had enjoyed far less social kudos than its German equivalent, and had failed to attract high-quality recruits in the numbers needed to create a core of high-quality NCOs. On the other hand, at least private soldiers who proved themselves in battle were not held back from being promoted to NCO. And even before the United States entered the war, the Army was taking further steps that would better enable it to meet the challenges of combat. There was colossal benefit, of course, in the industrial output of the globe's most powerful economy. The Army reduced the size of its infantry units but buttressed their firepower, equipping them with extra machine guns and mortars, together with the highly effective bazooka anti-tank rifle. Infantry divisions also became motorized with half-tracks and largely self-propelled artillery, while the Americans aped the Germans by making their armored divisions less tank-heavy and more balanced. Nevertheless, the Tunisian campaign harshly exposed the U.S. Army's continued shortcomings. The Americans felt compelled by the terrain to disperse their armor rather than concentrate it. They had far to go before they could practice combined arms warfare as proficiently as the Germans. Furthermore, because the Americans' grasp of maneuver warfare was found wanting, they often tried to compensate with an offensive-minded attitude, leading to some recklessly ill-advised attacks. The Americans' lack of experience in inter-service cooperation was clear in the ineffective air support they provided for their ground troops, nor, as yet, did they concentrate their artillery in the mass that was needed. The Germans' initially contemptuous view of the U.S. Army was colored not just by their military judgment, but also by Nazi racial stereotypes about the degenerate multicultural United States. "We fought the Army, American, a few days ago," wrote Lance Corporal Siegfried Kay of the 15th Panzer Division in mid-February 1943, "and destroyed over 90 of his tanks. We'll blow him and all his Negroes and trash races to perdition." Ironically, however, the severe racial segregation that characterized the U.S. Army at this time kept its African-American personnel away from frontline combat units. Alongside the U.S. troops in North Africa were Free French forces, including skilled mountain fighters from France's North African colonies. Such soldiers posed acute danger to Axis troops in the mountainous terrain of Tunisia. The other Allied contingent was the division-strong British First Army under General Kenneth Anderson. The First Army was a formation drawn from the Home Forces, troops who had been trained in Britain while the Eighth Army had fought Rommel in the Western Desert. It exhibited several of the weaknesses in the Home Forces' training and doctrine. For one thing, its troops suffered the shortcomings of the new British innovation of battle drill. Useful though this was, it was imparted to uneven standards across the different regiments. This was yet another symptom of the British Army's failure to create a system that disseminated good practice throughout its units. Nor did battle drill in itself enable British soldiers to achieve effective maneuver and firepower dominance on the battlefield. The British Army's inadequate dissemination of best practice was also apparent in the First Army's failure to concentrate its artillery more effectively and in its poor air support, defects the Eighth Army had suffered from but had since corrected. However, the Americans and the British First Army would prove faster learners than the Eighth Army. Further, General Alexander, in overall charge of the British land forces in North Africa, smoothed the learning process by alternating and coordinating attacks on the Axis from east and west after Montgomery's forces arrived from the east. This helped the Allies to maintain constant pressure on the Axis while giving their own formations the opportunity both to reflect and to recuperate. In mid-February, Rommel and Arnim buried their differences long enough to mount a two-pronged counterattack against the Americans. Arnim unleashed Operation Spring Breeze, employing two panzer divisions against U.S. formations along the main Allied line of the eastern dorsal. At one point, 1,500 American troops were encircled and captured, and the Americans pulled back their whole line to the western dorsal. Rommel's forces, the 15th Panzer Division and the Italian Centauro Armored Division, now launched Operation Morning Air from the south against U.S. defenses in the Kasserine Pass through the western dorsal. Rommel's 88s beat off U.S. counterattacks, and by 20 February, U.S. defenses at the pass had collapsed, the troops manning them fleeing with the loss of 200 tanks. Then, however, the Americans began their ascent of that steep learning curve. Their resistance stiffened, their artillery exacted heavy losses on the panzers, and Rommel was unable to exploit his success further. The Field Marshal later credited the Americans with the improvement they showed over the course of the battle. Although it was true that the American troops could not yet be compared with the veterans of the Eighth Army, they made up for their lack of experience by their far better and more plentiful equipment and their tactically more flexible command. Hans von Luck concurred, asserting in his memoirs that the Americans adapted immediately to a changed situation and fought with great doggedness. Rommel was also let down by Arnim. His Prussian colleague had refused to release part of one of his panzer divisions to support him, even when Kesselring had ordered Arnim to do so. Nor, this time, had Rommel helped himself. Rather than concentrating his attack on the American's weakest point, as time-honored German practice directed him to do, he had dissipated his offensive power by attacking at three different points. Another sign that Rommel's touch was wobbling came when Montgomery's recently arrived 8th Army repulsed his attack at Medinine on the Mareth line on 6 March. Medinine was essentially an action replay of Alamhalfa, but with even higher German losses. "The Marshal has made a balls of it," Montgomery reportedly remarked. The 8th Army was helped, as it had been since the summer of 1942, by complete air superiority and by ultra-decrypts revealing exactly where the Germans would attack. Furthermore, the advent of the 6-pounder gun had boosted the British Army's anti-tank capability. The British had yet to master combined arms operations fully. Among other things, their artillery was still not targeting the full depth of the enemy's defences effectively enough, and they were not deploying their forward anti-tank guns quickly enough. Yet the Tunisian campaign was enabling the British, like the Americans, to climb the combined arms learning curve. Indeed, by now, both the British and the Americans were firmly shedding their initial gung-ho attitude to armoured warfare, providing their tanks with vital infantry cover and coordinating their tanks and infantry increasingly effectively. In the air, the appointment of Air Marshal Sir Arthur Coningham as head of the whole of the Northwest African Tactical Air Force enabled him to transfer best practice from his old command of the Desert Air Force and greatly improve air-ground coordination. By mid-March 1943, the German army in North Africa had run out of road. The Axis supply basis in North Africa was already increasingly threadbare, and now Rommel and Arnim's offensives had used up all the remaining fuel. The Axis forces, despite further reinforcement, were now outnumbered 2-1. Such reinforcements as the Germans could get across to Tunisia could not alter the campaign's impending outcome. Rather, they were committed to the flames, as General Guderian later put it. A sign that the Germans knew the game was up was the German-Italian Panzer Army's latest and last name change, as it was redesignated the Italian First Army and placed under the command of General Giovanni Messe. Both this and the 5th Panzer Army were now placed under Rommel's command as Army Group Africa. Further attacks by Montgomery and by U.S. II Corps, now under General George S. Patton, did not make a decisive breakthrough, but did make good progress. With the collapse of the Mareth Line, abandoned by the Axis when the Italian First Army fled from it in disarray, the Allied armies in East and West linked up. The Luftwaffe in the Mediterranean theater, meanwhile, was being ripped to shreds. Between November 1942 and May 1943, it lost nearly 2,500 aircraft. This comprised over 40% of the Luftwaffe's entire strength as of 10 November 1942. Losses of this magnitude could not fail to affect the performance of the Luftwaffe in the East, either. But in the Mediterranean, they had the immediate effect of stripping Axis shipping of air cover. As a result, 623 panzers, 1,719 vehicles, and 1,413 artillery pieces earmarked for the Germans in North Africa ended up on the bottom of the sea. The Germans on the ground did not give up. In the middle of April, Corporal Karl B. of the 334th Infantry Division, a Kriemhild formation comprising replacement army units from various locations, wrote, "Our neighboring regiment was at the wire and destroyed a breakthrough attempt. Now we're expecting a visit in our sector, too, but we'll show the enemy what's what. Up to now we've had no anti-tank weapons, but our poor bloody infantry have stood up to iron and steel." But fierce as the Germans' resolve was, they could achieve no more than a holding action. By the standards of the North African campaign, the Germans' losses were calamitous. In the Wehrmacht report, my regiment was referred to by name. Grenadier Regiment 754 particularly distinguished itself, wrote Lance Corporal Karl B. 2 weeks later. There isn't much of the unit left now. By early May, the Tunisian campaign and with it the German army's war in North Africa were over. Around 250,000 Axis troops went into captivity. Rommel, already back in Germany, was not among them, though Arnim was. The end of the North African campaign, like the campaign as a whole, was more than a sideshow. More Axis troops surrendered in Tunisia than had surrendered in Stalingrad, even though only about half the 250,000 captured were combat troops, and only half the combat troops were German. The British Army in particular had used the North African campaign to improve its tactics and organization, while the U.S. Army had used its final phase as an opportunity to begin tempering its troops in battle. Moreover, the Americans' effective use of artillery presaged the overwhelming firepower that they and the rest of the Western Allies would employ in future campaigns. Both the British and U.S. armies then had benefited greatly from North African rehearsal space. The campaign's closing phase also further exposed the new limits to the German army's capability. Above all, its mastery of maneuver warfare could only achieve so much against an opponent with superior intelligence, air power, and land-based firepower. Strategically, the German army now faced a likely Italian collapse and an Allied invasion of Axis-controlled Europe from the south. Axis hopes of a complete triumph in North Africa had been based on shaky foundations from the start, but equally the Axis need not have been defeated quite so massively as it was. That the German army lost so many men and so much valuable equipment in Tunisia was ultimately the fault of Hitler and the High Command, albeit the OKW rather than the OKH this time. Hitler had made his small OKW staff, particularly General Jodl, responsible for the Tunisian bridgehead, largely as a way of further putting the OKH more firmly in its place. Given the pressure the German army was under on the Eastern Front in early 1943, it is questionable how many more troops could have been spared for Tunisia. But the OKW could at least have done a better job of timing the reinforcements, still more of timing a withdrawal, the disruption from Allied air power notwithstanding. Ultimately, however, nothing the OKW might have done differently would have altered some even more basic truths about the Tunisian campaign. The task of supplying and coordinating a binational expeditionary force by sea was not one that naturally fitted the German military. It fitted even less when that same sea route was exposed to air attack so devastatingly. Yet the only alternative, conceding the field to the Allies in North Africa and allowing Italy to collapse, was one Hitler would not countenance. Meanwhile, the Wehrmacht in the east was preparing that something special needed to stabilize the front there. German armaments production seemed to weigh in its favor. However, the German army still faced serious obstacles. Tank production was now being prioritized, but the cuts to aircraft production that this compelled harmed the army indirectly by reducing its air support. Further, there were more models of tank and armored fighting vehicle in production than were needed. This was a particular challenge for General Guderian, who, in March 1943, having pulled various strings to get back into Hitler's favor, was appointed Inspector General of Armored Troops. This gave Guderian authority over the formation, activation, and training of armored units, including those of the Luftwaffe and Waffen-SS, as well as of the army. Thus was Guderian able to achieve real progress in rationalizing armored vehicle production. He also oversaw considerable improvement in gunnery practice, but he worsened the spare parts situation by unequivocally backing Hitler's call for expanded panzer numbers. Nevertheless, German production of armored fighting vehicles had reached impressive levels by the summer of 1943. German industry had replenished panzer losses such that German forces in the east now had as many panzers as at the start of Operation Barbarossa. It coupled this with a rise in munitions productions by one-third between January 1943 and January 1944. The Army's panzer divisions still practiced the flexible tactics of old. Similar to the mobile box formations adopted by Rommel's panzer units in the desert, the divisions were now usually organized into battle groups, each focusing on its own allotted task. The divisional commander concerned himself with the overall picture, only altering a battle group's composition if it aided the overall battle plan. Thus did junior commanders continue to enjoy considerable freedom of action. On the other hand, the losses of the past 2 years had led to a dearth of sufficiently skilled and experienced commanders. Furthermore, numbers of armored fighting vehicles did not tell the full story. By July 1943, the German army on the Eastern Front deployed over 3,500 panzers and self-propelled assault guns, but fewer than half were actually with the army's panzer divisions. The remainder were allocated to divisions that had been redesignated as combined arms Panzergrenadier divisions, as well as to independent panzer and assault gun units. Furthermore, most of the army's panzers were still Mark III's and Mark IV's, rather than the new, heavier models. These, the Panthers and Tigers, together with a further huge number of vehicles, were largely being allotted to the ever more favoured Waffen-SS. Hitler and the OKH were less concerned about whom the panzers were allocated to than about having enough to allocate in the first place. They hoped to regain the initiative in the East, or at least surrender it no further, by launching a massive new offensive under the codename of Operation Citadel. The operation's target was to be the Kursk salient. The salient, which straddled the front lines of Army Group Center and Army Group South, had been formed by the Soviet advance of the previous winter. It now resembled a huge bulge in the German line. The plan for Citadel, penned by General Zeitzler, was to pinch out this bulge, destroy the Soviet forces within, and straighten the German line. This success would also dissuade the Reich's increasingly jittery European allies from having any ideas about leaving the Axis. As Hitler grandiloquently put it in April, the victory at Kursk must shine like a beacon to the world. That said, the fact that the operational scale of victory at Kursk would constitute no more than a local success was a measure of how straitened the Germans' means were now becoming compared with those of the Red Army. Such were the strategic motives. There were also political and psychological ones. Field Marshal von Kluge, commander of Army Group Center, believed the operation would give his army group a chance to wrestle back at least some of the limelight from Army Group South. Army Group South itself had been reformed from its constituent army groups of the 1942 campaign. Manstein, fresh from his triumph at Kharkov, wanted to replicate that success by letting the Soviets attack first and then hitting them hard with another backhand blow. However, this would have meant giving up the Donbass, something Hitler was loath to do even temporarily. Manstein feared that delaying Citadel increased the danger of the Western Allies preempting it by landing on the European continent. He also feared that delay would give the Red Army time to build up its defences in the salient. "Everything depends on not letting the initiative pass out of our hands," he wrote on 8 March. Hitler ignored Manstein on this score also, instead heeding the more cautious view of General Model, commander of the Ninth Army, that the offensive should be delayed. This might appear to have been one of those attacks of nerves that afflicted Hitler, according to Manstein's memoirs, when the Führer should have been bolder. Yet just as a rapid strike had something to recommend it, so too did delay. The Rasputitsa, caused by the spring thaw, compelled some delay, and there was an argument for building up the forces for the offensive further. And with numbers no longer favouring the Germans, it would be essential to weigh up carefully which other sectors of the Eastern Front could afford to shed troops and armour for Citadel. The downside of delay, of course, could be summarised as the bigger the build-up, the smaller the surprise. And another motive for delaying that Hitler may have harboured was more selfish than pragmatic, a desire to clip Manstein's wings a little after Kharkov. Allowing an alerted Red Army to build up its defences in the salient also posed a grave danger, simply because of the scale of material now at its disposal. Impressive as Germany's rearmament efforts were in 1943, Soviet armaments output continued to outdo them. In 1943, the Soviets produced 24,000 tanks and 48,000 heavy guns to the Germans' 17,000 and 27,000. The Red Army's tank force not only outnumbered that of the Germans, but also increasingly rivaled it for quality. From 1943, a new version of the T-34 came on stream, with a modified hatch and larger turret. This increased its visibility and made room for an extra crew member who could relieve the tank's commander of some of his burdens. The training of tank crews had also improved. For instance, each man was trained not only in his own specialism, but also in that of one of his fellow crew members so that he could take over smoothly if needed. Tanks often attracted the best recruits, partly because they looked so formidable and partly because they appealed to soldiers who were technically minded. Soviet arms factories were also producing more aircraft. The Sturmovik fighter bomber was an excellent piece of equipment, and even if it did not match the Stuka for quality, it narrowed the gap. Meanwhile, the Luftwaffe's heavy losses were compelling it to cut corners in training. This expedient, of course, was inherently destructive to the Luftwaffe in the long run because it rendered its pilots less effective and more likely to get killed. Soviet intelligence sources, not to mention the build-up of German forces north and south of the Kursk salient, gave the Red Army ample warning that an offensive was coming. Furthermore, the Germans gave the Red Army ever more time to prepare as the scheduling of Citadel slipped and slipped again. Not only did the dampness of the ground following the spring Rasputitsa compel delay, the fall of Tunisia caused Hitler to dither about whether or not to send some of the panzer divisions to southern Europe. Speer, fearing the disruption the offensive might inflict upon the flow of armaments production, called for Citadel to be cancelled altogether. This did not happen, but so legion were the technical problems besetting the new panzers and tigers that Hitler did postpone it yet again. By July 1943, the Soviets had used the four-month lull in the fighting along the Eastern Front to construct deeply echeloned defences along the entire front from Moscow to the Black Sea. They had paid special attention to the Kursk salient. They not only fortified it formidably, but also assembled huge reserves behind the front line. The Red Army forces in the salient now totaled about 1.8 million troops and 5,000 tanks, about double the number of tanks the Germans were committing to attacking it. Even if the operation succeeded, the cost of victory to the Germans might well be too high to be worthwhile. Several generals voiced their doubts, with even Manstein's resolve wavering as the offensive approached. Guderian, with Speer's agreement, wondered what the point of the offensive was at all, and it seems even Hitler was now plagued with doubts. Guderian's post-war memoirs provide an account of an exchange with Hitler and Keitel, which, given that several eyewitnesses were still alive when Guderian was writing, is probably accurate. "How many people do you think even know where Kursk is?" Guderian asked Keitel. "It's a matter of profound indifference to the world whether we hold Kursk or not. I repeat my question, why do we want to attack in the east at all this year?" This was Hitler's reply. "You're quite right. Whenever I think of this attack, my stomach turns over." The omens then were bad, but with Italy in particular needing a fortifying signal that the Wehrmacht was still in the game, and with so much psychological and material investment having gone into preparing the operation, cancellation was not an option. At the most basic level, there may also have been an element of something must be done at work, and Operation Citadel was something. The alternative was increasingly to surrender the initiative to a Red Army whose strength now burgeoned ever more ominously. Eventually, finally, Operation Citadel commenced on 5 July. The principal field armies committed to the attack were, in the north, the 9th Army and the 2nd Panzer Army, both of which General Model commanded for the duration of the operation, and, in the south, General Hoth's 4th Panzer Army. The entire force comprised 650,000 men, 2,600 tanks and assault guns, and 1,800 aircraft. Facing it, with their aforementioned solid advantage in manpower and armoured fighting vehicles, were the Central, Steppe and Voronezh fronts. Hoth and Model attacked in different ways, both flawed. Hoth sent in his armour ahead of the infantry, hoping to engage the Soviets' armoured reserves in a decisive engagement. However, he also wanted two northerly thrusts. This protected his eastern flank against Soviet counterattack, but it also dispersed his armoured strength and made him less able to force the decisive armoured engagement he was seeking. And Manstein failed to overrule him. Model, in contrast to Hoth, sent in his infantry first. In principle, sending in the infantry first to clear the way for the armour was a sound approach, but the Soviet defences in the Kursk salient were arrayed especially formidably. The root problem both commanders faced was that the Germans did not have enough armour. The Army's field commanders made every effort to impress the importance of the operation upon their troops. The 12th Panzer Division, for instance, conveyed Hitler's message that the operation that is about to commence will not only strengthen our own people, but above all infuse the German soldier himself with new self-confidence. Our allies' faith in final victory will be strengthened, and neutrals will be reminded not to intervene against us. The Russian defeat that this offensive will achieve will, in foreseeable time, rob the Soviet leadership of the initiative. But Unteroffizier Wolfgang S. of the 7th Panzer Division considered himself pretty skeptical about our chances, and judging by past experience, we can have little faith in either our company commander or our section commander. The Russian defenses have been prepared in advance and kitted out with all types of weapon. Furthermore, the Germans' air support came under massive direct pressure before Citadel had even started, as Soviet airstrikes hammered Luftwaffe airfields during the weeks leading up to it. Soviet aircraft and artillery likewise blasted the German forward areas just as Citadel was beginning. From the battle's start, the Legion technical problems that beset the new Panzer models were clear. Hauptfeldwebel Willy P. of the 167th Infantry Division, serving in the southern sector of the Eastern Front, venerated the Tiger as a marvelous machine without equal. But technical problems would plague it until later in 1943. Also in action at Kursk was a Tiger variant produced by Porsche. It was inferior to the Henschel Tiger variant that the Germans eventually selected, but its chassis formed the basis of the Ferdinand, a hybrid heavy tank destroyer and mobile assault gun. The Ferdinand's 88mm gun could destroy any opposing armored vehicle, but it was vulnerable to infantry attack because it lacked a machine gun. 200 Panthers were also employed at Kursk. The Panther was faster than the Tiger, but had only a 75mm gun compared with the Tiger's 88mm. Its entry into active service had also been particularly rushed. Its engine was defective, something that would not be corrected until 1944, and its poorly protected fuel system made it alarmingly likely to catch fire. Once its defects were overcome, the Panther would prove the finest tank Germany produced during the Second World War, but that lay in the future. The Panzers made painful, often negligible progress against Soviet anti-tank nests and artillery. "We've got hard days behind us," wrote Private Franz M. of the 7th Panzer Division on 10 July. "Our hearts were beating right up into our throats. This pack of gangsters would sooner be killed rather than surrender. The landscape's hilly, with one defense line after another. Plenty of comrades who enjoyed life as much as we did have fallen in the past few days. Army Group Center's forces managed only 6.5 kilometers, 4 miles, and by 12 July they had been halted. We're in the shit," wrote Private Helmut P. of the 198th Infantry Division that day, "guarding the flanks as the Russians attack fiercely again and again." By the end of the month, only 14 men of his company would be left standing. Army Group South, however, penetrated further because it was deploying the majority of the German armor. On 8 July, Lieutenant Heiner B. of the 12th Panzer Division wrote, "The Wehrmacht report reads, Russian attacks being repelled. In actual fact, we are the ones who are attacking. We are having good successes, above all the Luftwaffe, and also our Tigers." Indeed, for all their defects, the Panthers and Tigers held advantages over the T-34. Each had a crew of 5 to the T-34's 4. Though all Panzers had radio, only in 1943 did the Soviets properly address the lack of radio communication in their tanks. Soviet tank units were organized more hierarchically, which could cause chaos if a battle took an unexpected turn. Soviet tank crews remained less rigorously trained, and the Red Army was still developing its combined arms abilities. In particular, it had yet to employ Panzer Grenadier-type armored infantry. Little wonder, then, that tank for tank, the Germans came off better at Kursk than the Soviets. Soviet AFV losses during Citadel, at around 1,600 vehicles, were more than double those of the Germans. Indeed, it was superior doctrine, training, and equipment that enabled the Germans' main workhorse at Kursk, the Mark IV, to perform well even against the T-34. And the bulk of Mark IVs at the battle belonged not to the Waffen-SS, but to the Army. But if the Army's panzers fought better at the Battle of Kursk itself, the Waffen-SS edged the Army in the Battle of Perceptions that followed. The 3 Panzer Grenadier divisions of 2 SS Panzer Corps were better supplied with troops and artillery than any such Army division, save the Grossdeutschland. However, they did not perform appreciably better. They suffered losses that were heavy, but not abnormally so for formations that, after all, were Army Group South's mechanized spearhead during the battle. However, by stressing its losses at length after the battle, the Waffen-SS further underlined its fanatical spirit and cultivated an image as a fighting elite that, though not unjustified, was somewhat overdone. One veteran of the SS Panzergrenadier Division Totenkopf stated after the war, "We didn't feel like an elite, we were turned into one." But the disproportionate amount of decorations that the three Waffen-SS divisions received, not least the Knight's Cross with oak leaves awarded to their corps commander, SS Obergruppenführer Paul Hauser, was for propaganda purposes rather than an objective measure of the division's quality. The months following Kursk would see the Waffen-SS increasingly lauded and resourced at the army's continued expense. On 13 July, the day after a massive armored clash at Prakhorovka, Hitler called off Operation Citadel. The offensive had made slow progress and at heavy loss, but the final straw for Hitler was that much of the armor committed to Citadel was suddenly needed elsewhere. 3 days earlier, the Allies had invaded Sicily, and Germany's ally Italy was now under direct threat. Despite a numerical victory that would slow the Red Army's westward advance over the following months, the Wehrmacht had failed in its key objective of straightening out the German front line. Citadel's failure was not the turning point of the war on the Eastern Front, as is sometimes claimed. The Germans had inflicted higher losses upon the Soviets than the Soviets had on them. While their own losses, too, had been heavy, they were not irreplaceable. The Germans lost 252 Panzers and Sturmgeschütze during the battle, yet so prodigious were their production rates that they had received 817 new AFVs by the end of July. Nor, for the record, did Citadel spawn the largest tank battle in history, as has also sometimes been claimed. Its largest armored engagement at Prakhorovka was a fierce clash of arms, but not the Battle of Titans that the Soviet commander there, General P.A. Rotmistrov of the 5th Guards Tank Army, later claimed it to have been. Yet if Citadel was not a complete failure, neither was it anything like the success the Germans desperately needed. It had failed to pinch out the Kursk salient, straighten the German line, or hold the now disintegrating Axis coalition together. With its still considerable operational skill, the German army might inflict heavy losses and score local successes, but its most Herculean effort had not been enough, even temporarily, to wrest the initiative back from the Red Army. Despite its superior strength during Citadel, the Red Army had not defeated the Germans, but it had held them, and that was what mattered. Such, by now, were the Soviet Union's feats of armaments production, aided by Lend-Lease, and such also was the steady improvement in the Red Army's training and doctrine, that time was emphatically on the Red Army's side. Furthermore, such was the shifting balance of strength in the East that Citadel was the Germans' last major offensive there. Indeed, even before Hitler cancelled it, the Red Army was launching its own counteroffensive against German forces to the north of the Kursk salient. This was a more alarming development than the failure of Citadel itself, because it significantly confirmed that the initiative now lay firmly with the Soviets. The fact that Hitler eventually cancelled Citadel in direct response to the Allied invasion of Sicily demonstrated that the Germans in the East were now also being assailed by events on other fronts. The invasion once more exposed the failings of German military intelligence and counterintelligence. The Allies deceived the Axis into believing an invasion of southern Europe could come anywhere between Sardinia and the Peloponnese, and compelled the Axis to disperse its forces accordingly. The landing itself succeeded thanks to the Allies' overwhelming air and naval superiority, comprising 2,590 vessels and 3,600 aircraft, and to the innovative amphibious landing techniques they employed. This achievement foreshadowed the Normandy landings of 1944. The Allies, with Eisenhower in overall command, also attacked the Germans on Sicily from two sides. The British 8th Army landed at Syracuse in the southeast, the U.S. 7th Army in the southwest, a total of 180,000 men. But above all, the Allies were confronting the Germans with a type of warfare which they were barely used to and to which they had no viable answer. Lieutenant General Fridolin von Zenger-Etterlin, a German liaison officer on the island, put it succinctly in his memoirs. A large part of the strata of German political and military leaders thinks only in terms of land operations, not in the three-dimensional terms of forces of all arms. The issue could no longer be in doubt when one side possessed virtually only one branch of the armed forces, while the other could employ all three branches in sufficient strength to gain the objective. He also recalled his own reaction when he first saw the Allied armada. On July 12, 1943, I was only a few kilometers along the coast from Eisenhower, and having witnessed the same spectacle, I can completely endorse the words he then spoke to the United States Chief of Staff. I must say that the sight of hundreds of vessels with landing craft everywhere operating along the shoreline from Licata was unforgettable. Unforgettable it was, but differently so for me than for Eisenhower. Against all this, a large part of the Italian force on Sicily rapidly fell apart, a course of action for which, by now, it could hardly be blamed. The 28,000-strong German force on the island comprised the 15th Panzergrenadier Division, reconstituted using new recruits and remnants of the old 15th Panzer Division, and the Luftwaffe's Hermann Göring Panzer Division. They were grouped under Lieutenant General Hans Huber's 14 Panzer Corps. Huber's corps tried to react to the landings with the German Army's traditional operational method of a rapid, concentrated attack on the enemy's weak points. The Hermann Göring Division tried to destroy the American beachhead. What success it did achieve, however, swiftly brought its own problems. When the division made headway in the direction of the beach, it was hammered from a direction against which it had no answer whatsoever, Allied naval firepower. Sicily was the first time the Allies combined their unanswerable naval superiority with airstrikes and artillery to overwhelming effect against German land forces. Once the Allies were firmly ashore, the Americans' rapid progress showed their growing proficiency. While the British advanced more slowly, they too continued to innovate and improve. Among other things, they used spotter aircraft to call down devastating firepower on German counterattacks. Aerial spotter observation from the air was immensely useful in the mountainous terrain, and it was something the Germans themselves lacked. The 15th Panzer Grenadier Division described some of the effects Allied firepower had upon the German defences. The mounting destruction of telegraph wires by phosphorus bombs and enemy air activity massively hindered the transmissions of orders, it reported on 12 July. 3 weeks later, it described how the route east of Randazzo was coming under constant rolling air attack, then later artillery fire also, so much so that the division's troops called it the Road of Death. As far as possible, they had to move at night or during the enemy's tea break between the hours of 4 p.m. and 6 p.m., after which Allied fighter bombers harried them until darkness fell. However, both Army and Luftwaffe troops on Sicily distinguished themselves in the tenacious fighting retreat they conducted in order to escape the island. The Germans would seize a position on the high ground, wait for the Allies to attack, inflict heavy casualties, then retreat to the next similar position. For example, on 17 July, the 15th Panzergrenadier Division ordered its rearguard units to delay the Allied advance, while the rest of the division withdrew to new defensive positions. Units from its two regiments, the 104th and 129th, dealt out heavy losses to Allied tanks and trucks with artillery and rocket launcher fire, demolished the roads at numerous points, and repelled several Allied attacks over the following week. The 15th Panzer Division mauled the 1st Canadian Division particularly severely. Indeed, so embittered were the Canadians that, according to the 15th's after-action report, they shot the prisoners they took from one of the 104th's rocket launcher batteries. The whole of the 15th Panzer Grenadier Division was informed of the incident, and whatever the truth of the matter, it can only have reinforced the division's determination to resist. The Allies' advance, already heavily reliant on overwhelming firepower to break German resistance, became more cautious still against the 15th's spirited defence. Such actions gave General Huber the time he needed to organise the evacuation of the German troops on the island. Once the evacuation was underway, the Allies did not try to stop it. They feared German anti-aircraft fire across the Straits of Messina between Sicily and Italy, their air power was already preoccupied with bombing the Italian mainland, and they did not want to offer up their warships as easy targets in the Straits. Kesselring's memoirs claimed that the enemy failure to exploit the last chance of hindering the German forces crossing the Straits of Messina by continuous and strongly coordinated attacks from the sea and the air was almost a greater boon to the German command than their failure immediately to push their pursuit across the Straits on 17 August. Just as Montgomery had failed to pursue Rommel more ruthlessly after El Alamein then, the Allies on Sicily had failed to press their advantage while their foot was on the enemy's throat. Sicily was a grievous loss to the Axis nonetheless. It robbed the Luftwaffe of key bases, exposed Italy itself to the imminent prospect of Allied bombing and invasion, and enabled the Allies conclusively to reopen the Mediterranean as an east-west shipping route. Over the course of July, moreover, the Luftwaffe lost 711 aircraft over the Mediterranean. Indeed, together with the loss of 558 aircraft on the Eastern Front that month, July 1943 did more damage to the Luftwaffe than any other month over the course of the entire war. The German army, too, of course, would feel the effects sorely. During the spring and early summer of 1943, the German army's angle of descent towards eventual total defeat grew alarmingly steeper. This was despite its continued displays of tactical and operational flair, as at Kharkov, and its impressive resilience and resourcefulness in defensive warfare, as on Sicily. In Tunisia, the Allies' deficiencies in the ideal defensive terrain helped the Germans to slow the Allied advance, but no more. Nor could they conceal the fact that the U.S. and British-led forces were no longer the leaden-footed amateurs of wishful German thinking, if indeed they ever had been. For despite ongoing defects in the Allied coalition armies, they were now not only well-resourced, but also increasingly well-organized and led. That German soldiers still refused to recognize this is illustrated by the possibly apocryphal story of a British squaddie bundling German POWs into the back of a truck after the end of the Tunisian campaign. "British army no good," his captives cried. "Who put you in the back of the fucking cattle truck?" was his reply. Similarly, when the German generals in the East prepared Operation Citadel, they refused to recognize that the Wehrmacht's remaining technical, tactical, and operational strengths were no longer enough to deny the strategic initiative to an increasingly powerful and proficient Red Army. Hitler's vacillation over Citadel's start date shows that he instinctively recognized the offensive's fundamental limitations more than Field Marshal von Manstein did. Citadel's failure exposed the German army's new limitations even more mercilessly, as did the Allied invasion of Sicily. This brought to bear Allied strength in all three dimensions of the battlefield, on land, at sea, and in the air, against German defenders who, valiantly though they fought, could only marshal strength in one dimension. July 1943 was also the first time Allied success in one theater directly affected the Germans in another. And it also heralded a tug-of-war for resources between the OKH in the east and the OKW in the west. This dispute would go on to highlight the nonsensical dysfunction of a high command system with two heads. The Germans' painful predicament would worsen over the following 10 months. However, the German army would fight ever more desperately, both to defend the battlefronts and to maintain its hold over Germany's dwindling territory. It would continue to be aided by a war economy that was producing quality weaponry and equipment on a scale that, though it could not alter the war's eventual outcome, could at least delay it considerably. Part 4. Beleaguered. Chapter 17. Takeover in Southern Europe, 1943-1944. After Mussolini was deposed and Sicily fell, the new Italian government under Marshal Pietro Badoglio tried unsuccessfully to switch the country's support from the Axis to the Allies. The Allies had decided to invade Italy as a means of attacking German-occupied Europe via, in Churchill's infamous phrase, the soft underbelly of the Axis. The attritional slog of a campaign that was to follow would make a mockery of Churchill's words. Matters might have been different, however, had the Germans not moved so swiftly to take over the entire peninsula and deprive the Allies of an easy progress. The German takeover forced the Allies to reassess all their strategic hopes in the Mediterranean. But the manner in which the Germans conducted it also shone a harsh light on the mentality of senior Wehrmacht commanders as they entered the fifth year of war, and the lengths to which they were prepared to go in order to plug a gap in the Reich's now beleaguered front lines. The Germans took over not only Italy itself, but also the Italian-occupied territories of southern Europe. In addition to the mounting pressures they now faced on the battlefronts then, the German army and the Wehrmacht as a whole now had to take on a greatly magnified occupation commitment in areas that, particularly in the case of Italy's former Balkan territories, were slipping